Hello and welcome to Drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai. This is Bill Howell, your guide to all things craft beer on the Kenai Peninsula and across Alaska. First up, I want to thank everyone who submitted theme songs for our show. We got some great entries. We're looking at them and we'll be announcing the winner on our next show in May. In today's show, besides our standard beer news items, we'll also be doing an interview with a couple of local folks about SB 76, a complete rewrite of Alaska's liquor laws, which is currently in the legislature for consideration, a feature on which came first, beer or bread. Our beer style focus will be on Scotch Ale this month. And then finally, we'll do Beer Gear, where we talk about neat things out there for beer lovers. So stay tuned, and we're going to have a really good show. Okay, let's take a look at our beer news items for this month. First up, the Brewers Association has released its statistics for 2016. Sales of craft beer by volume were up 12.3% over 2015. The cash value of those sales was $23.5 billion, which represents a 21.9% share of a $107 billion U.S. beer market. Overall, there were 24.6 million barrels of craft beer produced in 2016, which represents a 6% growth over 2015. At the end of 2016, there were 5,234 craft breweries across the United States, employing 128,768 people. In the course of that year, 826 new breweries opened, while only 97 closed. So it looks like another good year for brewing across the United States. Moving to local news, Sacktown Liquors held its grand opening on the 14th of April. For those of you who are not familiar with it, this is a liquor store on the way into Seward, just across from the Pit Bar. They have a 14 growler beer tap, and they've been closed since July, and they reopened on the 14th under new management. Owner Jared Wallace has a lot of good plans for improvement. So if you're heading in or out of Seward, stop by and check out Sacktown Liquors. Cooper Landing Brewery has received its federal approval for its brewing license and is now working on receiving state approval. Kenai River Brewing Company will have new summer hours for its kitchen in its tap room. Starting on the 1st of May, the kitchen will be open 7 days a week. Currently, it's closed on Mondays and Tuesdays, but on the 1st of May, it will be open 7 days a week. And beginning in June, the kitchen will be open from 11 in the morning until 7:45 in the evening. Currently, the kitchen is only open from noon to 7:30. Seward Brewing Company will reopen for its summer season on Thursday, May 4th. 49th State Brewing in Healy opened again on Friday, May 28th. Both of those are seasonal brew pubs that close during the winter, but they will be opening on those dates. In Ketchikan, Baleen Brewing has submitted for local and state license approval. That's a brewery that's been in the works for several years, but looks like they're getting close to finally being able to open, so that's good news for Ketchikan. Founders Brewing Company out of Grand Rapids, Michigan, has announced that they've partnered with Odom Corporation, one of our local distributors, to bring their year-round seasonal and specially barrel-aged series of beers to Alaska. They should be on the shelves beginning early May, and the retail release will be on May 8th. A new small brewery has opened in Juneau. Barnaby Brewing opened for business on Friday, April 21st. The brewery is located at 206 North Franklin Street in downtown Juneau and is quite small, with only 800 square feet for the brewing floor and 250 square feet for the tap room. I had a phone interview with owner Matt Barnaby, and he related that he brews on a one-barrel all-electric system, which is very practical for him. Given the small size of his brewing system, it's only a single-barrel system, he has no plans to distribute any of his beer off-site. He'll be offering 4 standard beers, 10 rotating seasonals, and 5 imperial brews that will also rotate. According to Matt, his brewing philosophy is to produce mostly typical American ales, but to also mix in some of the less common styles, such as steam beers, cream ales, and American lagers. Until Barnaby Brewing opened, Alaska's capital city hasn't been home to any brewery besides the venerable Alaskan Brewing Company since the Dillo Brewery, located in the Armadillo Tex-Mex restaurant, operated for a brief period in the late 1990s. Baranoff Island Brewing Company in Sitka has become the first business to sell shares under a new Alaska crowdfunding law, which passed the legislature last July. The law opens a hitherto untapped source of financing for entrepreneurs by allowing local businesses to sell ownership stakes to Alaska residents. Baranoff Island first opened for business in 2010 and has expanded steadily since then. In February of 2016, the brewery received a $350,000 developmental loan from the city of Sitka. In mid-March of this year, the company began selling shares at $100 each, with the stated goal of selling 1,000 shares to raise $1 million to support more brewery expansion. If fully subscribed, this equity sale would represent a 37% share of the $2.7 million business. While the three current owners, Rick Armstrong, his wife Suzanne Hess, and partner Hans von Rakowski, will retain majority control, two representatives of the shareholders would join them on a new five-person corporate board. Armstrong hopes fresh infusion of capital can go towards purchasing a new brewing system that will help him produce more beer to meet increasing distribution demands. Although billed as an investment, the act of buying a share of the brewing company more closely resembles a donation at this point. Shares have no market value, and indeed there is no market to sell them on, meaning that even if the company rises in value, there is no way to monetize those gains. Armstrong has stated that he hopes that eventually these shares will pay dividends to their owners, but even under a best-case scenario, such dividends would likely take 5 to 10 years to materialize. Alaskan Brewing has announced that it's adding Big Mountain Pale Ale to its year-round beer lineup. This beer was originally released as part of the brewery's Boundary Range sampler pack and is brewed using the popular Simcoe and Mosaic hop varieties. Alaskan has replaced Big Mountain in the Boundary Range pack with a new beer, Ridge Hop IPA. This beer is brewed using a single hop variety, Azaka hops from Australia. These hops give it notes of citrus, pine, and grass. Ridge Hop IPA will only be available in the sampler pack. Denali Brewing Company has added a new brew to its seasonal offerings of canned beers. Big Dippa is a double IPA brewed with a blend of Zeus, Simcoe, Centennial, Cascade, and Chinook hops. Over 5 pounds of hops are added per barrel for a massive 100 IBUs. Obviously, such a hoppy beer needs a strong backbone to support it, and Big Dippa has that as well, weighing in at 8.6% alcohol by volume. That wraps up the news. In our next section, we'll have an interview with Doug Hoag of Kenai River Brewing and Stephanie Queen of the City of Soldotna about SB 76. Hi, this is Drinking on the Last Frontier with Bill Howell on KDLL FM 91.9. One of the big concerns right now is SB 76. It's a bill in the legislature to completely rewrite Alaska's liquor laws. This happens every 30 or 40 years. The last time there was a complete rewrite was back in 1986. And this bill was introduced last year, and of course nothing happened because the legislature didn't do much of anything last year. And it's been introduced again this year, and it looks like probably not much is going to happen because the legislature is still busy fighting over budgets and taxes and permanent funds. But on the off chance that something does happen, I thought it would be good for our listeners to know something about this since it could seriously impact the availability of beer, wine, alcohol, various other things. And it's of particular interest here on the Central Peninsula because the person taking the lead on this bill is our Senator Pete Michicki. Today we're at the Kenai River Brewing Company in the tap room, and I've asked a couple of local folks who have a dog in the fight to come and talk to us about SB 76. We've got Stephanie Queen from the City of Soldotna and Doug Hoag, the owner of Kenai River Brewing. So let's start with you, Stephanie. What are some of the city's concerns with SB 76 as written?
I got involved probably about 2 years ago, and it was because a local business owner had some concerns trying to get a beer and wine license at his restaurant. And he'd gone to the state, and they told him what he needed to do. In his case, he needed to get 1,200 signatures, and he was having a hard time meeting that goal. And so he was asking around for help. He reached out to Senator Michicki's office. He reached out to us at the city, and I wasn't very familiar with liquor laws as an outsider of that industry. My first thought was, that doesn't sound right. Let me learn a bit more about it and do some research and see if there's something we can do to help. So sure enough, I started reaching out to staff at the ABC board, met with the director over the phone, started reading the statutes. And the more and more I read, it was kind of like falling down a rabbit hole. It was just intriguing to me how complicated, how many hoops to jump through, and how many different ways that these statutes could negatively impact, in my perception, negatively impact what businesses are trying to do in our community. So it started with that one restaurant owner, but the more and more I read, the more I got interested in potentially being involved in improving some of that language and some of the regulations. So about the same time, we were made aware that there was a stakeholder group that was working on this. They'd been at that time meeting for years already. It's been about a four-year process. So we came in on the tail end of that, but our objective initially was to give some of our local business owners a bit more autonomy. Some of the formulas they have for licenses across the state we felt didn't work very well in Soldotna. It was really restrictive from how our businesses work and move around. And so initially our interest was just having a seat at that table, trying to have a seat at that table to give a different perspective, which is one of a community has our own goals, has our own interests in promoting our downtown and promoting our local businesses to help them thrive. And I felt like some of the existing language in the code was really preventing that.
From a consumer's perspective, it often seems like the liquor laws in the state of Alaska are written to discourage new businesses opening and new breweries and new eating places from opening as opposed to encouraging them. And given the state of the state's economy right now, it seems kind of a shame that the direction that this law, what it was written in, seems to be to see how many barriers we can throw up as opposed to how can we encourage people to start new businesses and have value-added products and things like that. So would you say that the current version of it as written addresses the concerns that the city had in those aspects?
So I think we'll probably talk a lot about breweries in a minute when Doug shares some of his thoughts. When it comes to the restaurant issue, the existing scenario of collecting signatures, I think, is bad for businesses. And it's administered differently all around the borough. So there was pretty much universal agreement from the folks at the table that process had to go. What we hoped it would be replaced with is the ability for cities like ours who understand our local businesses, we know them personally, we know what they need and what our goals for our community are. We hoped that it would be replaced with a process that would give local communities more authority, more autonomy to set our own numbers in terms of the different types of licenses. The proposal that's in the bill for restaurant and eating places, those are just the beer and wine licenses, it's something like that. So there's a new process that would allow a city council to petition the ABC board for a set number of restaurant eating place licenses. So I'm hopeful that it will help us get to our goal. We know of many restaurants in Soldotna right now that would pursue that opportunity, that license type, if given a chance. And one of the first things I did was kind of go door to door of our existing restaurants to see how they feel about that. How would they feel about us taking a position, trying to increase their competition? And of the restaurant owners who already have this license, they were fully in support. They felt like it was overly restrictive. They supported us trying to get a few more beer and wine licenses for restaurants. So I felt comfortable that we weren't putting ourselves in a position that was at odds with half of our business community. So that process is in the draft. It's never been used. It's brand new. So I'm hopeful that if it gets adopted, it would give the city of Soldotna more flexibility when it comes to that one issue. The other thing we worked really closely on was to provide flexibility with businesses in the borough to come and go from cities, inside and outside cities. Right now, there's kind of a bright line around each city, and the licenses in that city have to stay in, and the licenses outside have to stay out. So we had a business owner relocate his business recently from Sterling to Soldotna, and when he came into the city, he had to give away the license. It just went away, because outside the borough, there are licenses available. Inside, we're totally full. So turns out in this case, there was already a process that allows licenses to move into a city, but it was written for the Mat-Su. It only applied in the Mat-Su borough because they have at least 60,000 people. That was the number that's in the code. Well, we've got 58,000. We're almost there. And yet here's this process that they get to utilize that our businesses don't. So one of the other things we worked in that's in the draft would be that existing licenses, if they're available in your borough, up to 3 times a decade, they can move into a city. So this is not just something for Soldotna. It would potentially allow a business owner to move into Homer, to move into Kenai, any of the cities that are totally maxed out in the number of licenses. If there's an existing beverage dispensary or package store out in the borough that's for sale, if they wanted to acquire that and potentially relocate into the one of the cities, they'd be able to do that. And again, this was a process that exists for the Mat-Su. We had no idea it even existed. We just worked to say, hey, if that's something that you guys are comfortable with that works up there, maybe we can allow that to happen on the Kenai too. As far as the regulation about brewery, I'm really curious to see what Doug and Bill, those guys are the beer experts.
Thanks, Stephanie. It seems to me too that one of the issues that we're looking at too is, does this allow for development and growth and change, as you mentioned, for the restaurant to be able to move from out in Sterling, I think I know who you're talking about, moving into Soldotna, is that something that, you know, that flexibility exists? So one of my concerns is the new licenses, what impact is that going to have on the potential for new breweries to open up in the area and around the state? So that's why I wanted to have Doug here so that he could tell us, based on his experience of 10 years in the business and what it was like getting started, what he thinks of some of these new proposed changes. So, Doug?
Kind of reflecting on something that Bill said just a little bit ago, I have a mantra that I like to say about the ABC board quite a bit. So the ABC board used to be housed under the Department of Justice. Now it's under the Department of Commerce, but really all it does is restrict commerce at this point. It restricts commerce currently, and it's going to continue to restrict commerce with this new rewrite. So one part that's in the bill that they're looking at with microbreweries with having a manufacturing license is that they want to impose an 80%, 20% rule. And that means that only 20% of what you manufacture can be sold in your tap room to consumers. So that will basically eliminate any new brewery in the state of Alaska from opening up unless they have an automatic market, which is a pretty difficult thing to establish. There are a number of breweries that have actually been in operation for a number of years, and they're running probably 80 to 90% of everything out of their tap room. So I guess that's my biggest concern, is that we have one of the fastest growing industries in the nation when you look at alcohol, and what this is going to do is eliminate any further growth in the state of Alaska. So that concerns me a lot. The more microbreweries we have in the state, the more people stop drinking some of the big name beers, and that just makes it good for everybody. We get people drinking more craft beer. One of the big things with craft beer is you're drinking for flavor, and you drink a little bit less because it's fulfilling. and it's not like drinking, you know, 14 of the mass market light lagers that they throw at you. So this makes it, I think, in my mind, a little bit better for everyone looking at that. But that's my biggest concern, is seeing that 80%, 20% rule, because we're not going to see the growth anymore. We're not going to see new breweries like Girdwood Brewing that just opened up in Girdwood, or some smaller places in Anchorage opening up even, because it just restricts it.
Just off the top of my head, I mean, I can think of a couple of places, Grace Ridge Brewing down in Homer, Kodiak Island Brewing probably. I mean, I don't know Ben Split, but I doubt it's 80-20. You know, and as Doug mentioned, Girdwood Brewing, any new brewery that would open up, unless they have got some sort of a built-in market where they can distribute their beers, it'd be impossible for them to meet an 80-20 split. And of course, the law as written grandfathers all of our existing breweries, which begs the question, if this is such a good idea, why do we have to grandfather our existing breweries? So I think right there, that gives away the game, which is the fact that they have to put a grandfather clause in, indicates it's not a good deal for anybody, particularly anybody who's coming up the road behind it. So I don't know what exactly is going to happen. Who knows? The legislature doesn't look like they're going to get much done this year. But at some point, this issue is going to come up. So if you're a consumer of alcohol in the state of Alaska, this is really something you should pay attention to. Because for all the people who are deciding these questions, there really isn't anybody representing the consumer at the table, except possibly for your legislative representatives and senators. So eventually we may need to make them feel the heat.
One of the things that was talked a lot about in the process is protecting public health and safety, and we at the city are deeply invested in that goal as well. The breweries, the restaurants, those are liquor license types that we see as really low risk. They're not places where we devote a lot of resources sending SPD, or not places where we have a lot of concerns with people serving minors or over-consuming. But on the flip side, they're the types of businesses in our community that are really important to quality of life. They're really important to furthering our other goals about having events year-round and bringing people to our community, or encouraging people to move back after college or want to live here. So for us, it felt like the restrictions, particularly around these type of businesses, are really running counter to some of our other longer-term goals, and that by fighting for a few more of them in our community, if we feel they make sense, felt like something worth investing some time into. And like I said, not necessarily to attract new businesses, but just to help the existing businesses we have thrive. So it made a lot of sense for us to get involved. I'm hopeful there's some positive language in, but as Bill mentioned, it's just something that we'll have to stay really involved in to see if it makes it all the way through, and what that language looks like when it gets to the finish line.
So, Stephanie, one question that comes up, given the fact that the Alcohol Control Board just had marijuana dumped into their lap last year, how's the staffing and responsiveness up there? I know statewide we're paying over $40 million in alcohol taxes, the second highest in the nation, and you would think with that kind of money the state would be able to handle things. So how's things working up at the board?
Well, I think another reason we're getting more involved is because our businesses reach out to folks at the state, and I've got a lot of respect for some people in that office. They're just completely overbooked and overworked. They've got so much on their plate. And so another reason that we took the time to learn up a bit more about the state's laws, even though we can't control them, we don't administer them, is just to help business owners who are struggling. I mean, it's really complicated. There's a lot of process involved. And even the book, it's hundreds of pages long, and you need to know all those details. So this is a really important portion of our economy. It's a really important to our business owners. I hope that the state's able to get a few more resources so that they can adequately handle that workload, because I know there's good people up there trying to do right by our businesses. They've just got a lot on their plate right now.
Well, it would seem to me that one model that would work would be to delegate some of this authority, as you mentioned, down to the cities and the municipalities, and let them basically be responsible for what's going on inside their own borders. And that would take that load off the state and let them focus on the unincorporated areas and the places that aren't inside cities. It would seem to me that the city of Soldotna probably has as good a grasp on how many liquor licenses it needs as the state of Alaska does. It always seems to me that the closer you can have the person to the problem, the better understanding they're going to have of how to handle it. The further away you get, the more you devolve into a one-size-fits-it-all kind of situation.
We agree. I mean, I think we can identify problems here and get some solutions. The challenge with legislation like this is that it's statewide. So whenever we come up with a scenario or a problem here in Homer or in the peninsula or out in the borough, there's someone at the table who can say, but what about Bethel or what about Juneau? So they're trying to draft this legislation that applies to the entire state when our communities are so diverse, so different. Our populations are different. Our visitor community is different. So the ability to have a bit more stake at the table in decision making is definitely something we support, just because, like I said, we know our business owners by name. We can get to know their issues and hopefully address them quicker than something that has to go through this big process at the state level.
Well, that's it for the interview. Thanks to, once again, to Stephanie Queen and Doug Hoag for taking their time out to talk to us about this. As I mentioned, this is Senate Bill 76 that we're talking about. If you're curious and have a couple of hours of your life to waste, you can go onto the legislative website, pull off a copy like I did, read it over like I did, have blood come from your eyes like I did, But even though this seems like a lot of legalese, it's critically important for our future and the future of wine, beer, and distilled spirits production in the state of Alaska. So if this is something you're concerned about, something you need to stay on top of. I'll do my best here on the radio to give you a heads up when there's some developments in this. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier at KDLL FM 91.9 Kenai. This is Bill Howell, your guide to all things beer and the last frontier. In today's feature story, we're going to discuss which came first, beer or bread. For over a half a century, one of the perennial arguments among anthropologists has been why mankind decided to shift from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to one based on agriculture. Prior to the middle of the 20th century, the subject was not really open to debate. Given the obvious, in hindsight, benefits that accrued from agriculture and the bread it produced, cities, writing, trade, etc., the assumption was that of course people settled down and began growing cereal grains in order to make bread. However, in 1953, the archaeologist Robert Braidwood posed this question to his colleagues during a now famous symposium. Quote, "Could the discovery that a mash of fermented grain yielded a palatable and nutritious beverage have acted as a greater stimulant towards the experimental selection and breeding of the cereals than the discovery of flour and bread making? One would assume that the utilization of wild cereals, along with edible roots and berries, as a source of collected food, would have been in existence for millennia before their domestication, in a meaningful sense, took place. Was the subsequent impetus to this domestication beer or bread?" End quote. While raged might be too strong a word, the academic discussion of this intriguing question went back and forth for about 60 years, with neither side being able to make any sort of compelling argument for its position. Food is a more basic need, and in the absence of evidence, many folks believed bread seemed the likely spark to a change as revolutionary as domesticating crops. Others argued that the hunter-gatherer lifestyle provided plenty of nutrition. What it lacked was alcohol, whose mind and mood-altering effects would certainly have been in great demand amongst our Neolithic ancestors. As a beer lover, you can probably guess which side of the argument I personally came down on, but it seemed as though the argument would defy any true resolution due to the absence of hard evidence one way or the other. However, all that changed in 2012. Göbekli Tepe is an archaeological site in Turkey that has challenged fundamental ideas about the transition humans took from Neolithic hunter-gatherers to becoming settled agriculturalists. The site consists of a number of buildings. Previously, when archaeologists unearthed sites of human construction, they assumed that the structures dated from a period of civilization. Buildings equaled settlements. But Göbekli Tepe stood this theory on its head. Its buildings are of a particular type. Marked by T-shaped pillars up to 20 feet high, weighing 16 tons, archaeologists believe them to be worship sites, not dwellings. More intriguingly, there are no permanent settlements nearby. These structures were erected 12,000 years ago, but not as a part of early human civilization, but rather a precursor to it. Even more fascinating, from the beer lover's point of view, was the discovery of six large limestone vessels. These barrel or trough-shaped vessels, with capacities up to 160 liters, were noted to carry gray-black adhesions. Analyses made on these substances returned positive for calcium oxalate, also known as beer stone, a substance which develops in the course of the soaking, mashing, and fermenting of grain. So here we have evidence of brewing taking place at Göbekli Tepe well before settled agriculture. Even more intriguingly, results from genetic analyses undertaken by a team from the Norwegian University of Life Sciences in Oslo have suggested that the earliest domestication of grain occurred in the very near vicinity of Göbekli Tepe. Given that Göbekli Tepe seems to be primarily a ritual religious site, it's easy to postulate that hunter-gatherers from the surrounding area would gather there periodically to worship and labor on building and expanding the site. The entire complex was probably built over several generations, just like the great Gothic cathedrals of Europe. Production and consumption of alcoholic beverages and ritual feasting was probably a key element in the social glue that could bring these disparate and nomadic groups together on a regular basis. Alcohol serves both ritual and social functions and has a magical, transcendent, mind-altering capacity. Unlike food, which appears naturally in the environment, alcohol must be manufactured. Humans didn't need to settle down to produce food. If the structures on Göbekli Tepe tell us anything, it's that 12,000 years ago, our ancestors had enough surplus time and energy that they could use it to build the equivalent of a Neolithic cathedral. The motivation to produce beer, a substance they could not reliably produce without agriculture, would be a pretty obvious one for Neolithic people looking to spend more time praying, celebrating, and feasting. So, while the debate is by no means 100% settled, arguments appear to be tilting strongly toward the beer side of the question. If true, this means we have beer to thank for all the blessings and problems that we have received from what we so optimistically call civilization. As Homer Simpson says, here's to alcohol, the cause of and solution to all life's problems. So that's something to think about, the role of beer in the birth of civilization. Next up, we'll be talking about our style of the month, Scotch Ale or Wee Heavy. Welcome back. This is Bill Howell, your guide to drinking on the last frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai. Our beer style for this month is a personal favorite of mine, Scotch Ale. I've been drinking craft beer for over 30 years, and one of the very first craft beer styles that I was introduced to was Scotch Ale. Scotch Ale needs to be differentiated from its near cousin, Scottish Ale. As you would gather from their names, both of them were brewed in Scotland. But the Scottish ale style, good local example would be Kenai River Brewing's Skelack Scottish, is a lower alcohol version, runs in the neighborhood of 5 to 6.5, 7% alcohol. Scotch ale, or as it's sometimes called, wee heavy, is a much stronger version in the 8 to 10% alcohol range. Scottish ales are sometimes delineated by numbers, 60, 70, 80. This numbering system refers to an old tax system in Scotland where beers were taxed a certain number of shillings based on the amount of malt that were used. The higher the number, the stronger the beer. But Scotch ale doesn't really fall into that numbering system. As I said, it was a considerably stronger beer than Scottish ale. Your flavor profile for your typical Scotch ale is very strong emphasis on the malt. The use of hops in Scottish beers was limited, as that hops typically needed to be imported from England. They don't grow normally in Scotland, so the Scottish beer styles tend to emphasize malt rather than hops. They also tend to have a clean flavor due to the lower temperature fermentation. Scotland is naturally a rather cold country, so beers there tend to ferment at lower temperatures, even their ales, producing a cleaner flavor profile. Scotch ale is not typically smoked. This is a bit of a misnomer that has developed over the years because of the popularity of Scotch whiskey. The assumption was that Scottish beers would also have peat or smoke flavors in them. All historical research seems to indicate that is not the case. Scots stopped using smoke in their beers as soon as they could, just like everybody else. And while they maintained the peat-smoked whiskeys, their ales did not have any appreciable smoke presence. That being said, when I brew my homebrew version of Scotch ale, I throw a little peat malt in it because I like the way peat smoke tastes, but I won't pretend that it's historically accurate. In the appearance, most Scotch ales are a deep ruby color, and as I said, they have a strong malt aspect to them. They also pair well very well with Scotch whiskey, a very popular choice in Scotland. If you spend any time in the pubs there, you'll hear someone order a wee dram and a beer. What they're asking for is a dram of whiskey and then a half pint of Scotch ale to chase it with. Among the commercial Scotch ales out there, one of my personal favorites is Edinburgh Strong Ale, which is no longer produced by Caledonian Brewing Company in Edinburgh, but in the early 90s, late 80s, was imported into the United States in a bottle form known as McAndrew's Scotch Ale. I discovered this, as I said, in 1989, and it was a real favorite of mine for as long as it was available. I was lucky enough to be able to taste it in Scotland on a cask condition, and it was truly a magnificent beer. So that's Scotch Ale. If you're looking to try local examples, Kenai River Brewing, as I mentioned, produces a Scottish Ale, which is a lower strength version, but does on occasion produce a wee heavy version of its Skelach Scottish. Cassock's Brewery produces its Caribou Kilt Wee Heavy, which is a bottled version of Scotch Ale. And St. Elias Brewing has on occasion produced a Scotch Ale as well. Midnight Sun Brewing in Anchorage produces on occasion Full Curl Scottish Ale. It was once one of their regular bottle productions, but declining demand has relegated to a seasonal status. Finally, what do you pair Scotch Ale with when you're pairing it with food? I find it personally that it goes very well with game dishes, venison, stews, very hearty, robust meals. You think about Scottish cuisine, things like haggis and neeps and tatties. This is a fairly strong flavored, savory food, and Scotch ale pairs extremely well with those. It also does well with sweet desserts, chocolate desserts, or things like bread pudding or toffees. So it makes an excellent accompaniment to any of those. So that's our style for this month. Scotch ale, as I said, one of my personal favorites. It's not hoppy like IPAs, so for those of you out there who don't like hoppy beers, make sure you give Scotch ale a try. Next up, I'll be answering questions that you, the listeners, have sent in about beer and brewing, so stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Bill Howell with Drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai, and it's time for your questions. Remember, if you've got any questions about beer and brewing, you can send me an email at beerontthelastfrontier or post on KDLL's Facebook page. So please let us know if you've got any questions about beer and brewing. So what's our question for today?
Hey, Bill. This is Jenny, your producer at KDLL. This month's submitted question is, Anchorage Brewing Company just did a limited release beer. From what I hear, it's made with some kind of new science fiction-sounding way to process hops. Can you fill me in on this?
Yeah, that's a great question. The beer you're referring to is called Lines, and it was brewed in a collaboration between Gabe Fletcher of Anchorage Brewing Company and Monkish Brewing, which is actually located in Los Angeles. So while Gabe was in Southern California a while back, he went over to the brewery there, and they did this collaboration brew. And once it was finished, the Monkish Brewing shipped a couple of cases, or I don't know how many pallets of this stuff, up to Gabe in Anchorage, where and he released it at the brewery. But the fascinating thing about this beer is that it was made 100% using this new type of hop process. Some people call it hop dust, other people call it cryo hops. And what they've done is, if you're familiar with hops, they're actually a flower. If you've ever seen a picture of a hop, it's hop flowers. So when you're harvesting hops, you typically will take the hop flower and it gets dried, and then it's either pelletized, turned into these pellets that look like kind of like rabbit food, or it's baled, a big bale of the flower petals. And then the brewers have the choice. They can use either quote-unquote whole hops, which are the flower petals, or hop pellets, which are the pelletized, like I said, it looks kind of like rabbit food. But this new process, what it does is it basically completely separates the leaf part of the hop from the hop glands, which are these little oil glands in the flower that have all the essential oils that give you the hop flavor, the hop bitterness. And there's a whole slew of different chemical compounds that are in these oils, but that's what you really want. The leaf doesn't really contribute anything, and in fact, by having too much leaf, you can get off flavors into the beer. If you add a lot of whole leaf hops or whatever, you can get kind of a vegetal taste from all of this extra plant matter that's being added into a beer when you're trying to make a really hoppy beer. So this new process, they separate just the individual glands out, and they basically freeze dry them with liquid nitrogen. So it preserves them, and it effectively, what you're doing is you're concentrating. So, you know, an ounce of this stuff is like, I don't know, like a pound of hops, right, of whole hops. So you can use this stuff to make some really hoppy beers, or at least that's what folks are thinking. This whole thing is so new. It's only been around for a few months. Like I said, this beer that Gabe made in collaboration down in L.A., to my knowledge, it's the first beer that anybody's ever made in the entire world that was 100% just this powder used to hop it, rather than maybe adding some of this powder in addition to regular hops. So it's a really fascinating new technological triumph to be able to take just these critical elements from the hops and preserve them and produce this powder. What it's going to mean for brewing overall is still an open question. Like I said, brewers are just starting to experiment with this stuff. So it could turn out to be just kind of a passing fad, a cool thing that doesn't really lead to very much, or it could mean a whole new world of really strong, flavorful, hopped beers without having to worry about getting any of these off flavors from using too much vegetable matter. The downside of these things, of course, is they're much more expensive than regular hops, given this all this extra processing that they have to go through. So the jury's still out, but it's a fascinating new technical aspect to brewing. And I'm personally looking forward to having a chance to try some of these beers made with this stuff and see what they taste like. So thanks. That's a great question. Anybody else out there that's got any questions about beer or brewing, please throw them my way, and I'll do my best to answer them. Next up, we'll be talking about beer gear, things for the beer lover that they can't drink. So stay tuned. Hello, and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai. This is Bill Howell, your guide to beer. And we're talking about beer gear now. This is our segment on things for the beer lover that they can't drink. First up, I'd like to talk about beer magazines. There's quite a few beer magazines out there available these days, which is a change from 20 or 30 years ago when there was really only one. And that magazine was all about beer. It's the oldest. It comes out every other month. And it really is a good overview of what's going on in the beer business and across various different breweries. If you need a fix on a more frequent basis, a relative newcomer is Beer Advocate. By relative, I mean it's only been around for about 10 years. But Beer Advocate is a monthly magazine produced by Jason and Todd Alstrom out of Boston, Massachusetts, that does an exceptionally good job also of covering new developments, new releases, and trends in the beer world. A couple of other fairly recent additions are Beer Connoisseur magazine and Draft magazine, which each takes their own different approach to what's available out there in the beer world. Moving into magazines that actually have some home brewing emphasis, the oldest, of course, is Zymergy. This is the magazine of the American Home Brewers Association. You get a subscription with your Home Brewers Association membership, and it's been around since about 1979. So it is definitely one of the older magazines out there dealing with home brewing. Newer, but still quite good, is Brew Your Own magazine. As somebody who's been home brewing for about 30 years, Brew Your Own reminds me of Zymergy from 25 years ago, in that there's a lot more emphasis on how to homebrew ideas and a little less emphasis on kind of the slick advertising that you see a lot of in Zymergy magazine. And then straddling the line between the two worlds is Craft Beer and Brewing magazine. About half of that magazine is devoted to homebrewing ideas, topics, suggestions, and the other half focuses on the brewing business and commercial beers. So those are some options out there for the beer lover. As I said, if I was going to pick one, I would probably go with Beer Advocate magazine, for no other reason than it comes out every month, so you get your fix that much more often. And from the How to Brew magazines, I would recommend Brew Your Own. But they're all good magazines, and I subscribe to most of them, so there's plenty to see and read there. Another category that's out there are what are called brew newspapers. And unlike beer magazines, which are typically glossy, regular magazines, these are more like newspapers. They're printed on newsprint rather than glossy paper. And their focus is on the news with regards to breweries, breweries opening, breweries closing, new developments, those kind of things. The oldest of the bunch is the Celebrator, which covers the entire country. Different authors cover different sections. The Aurora Borealis column is written by James Roberts, a.k.a. Dr. Fermento, who also writes for the Anchorage Press. That covers the Alaska section. As I said, the Celebrator is a nationwide coverage. There's then another group which break up the country and do specific areas like Yankee Brew News, Midwest Brew News, those sorts of things. Alaska belongs to Northwest Brewing News. I happen to be the Alaska correspondent for Northwest Brewing News, so I guess I'm a little bit biased, but I find it to be a good magazine, a good newspaper to keep up with developments in the area. And the other nice thing about the Northwest Brewing News is they typically send free copies to any brewery tap room that's interested. So if you swing by Kenai River Brewing or one of the other breweries, you're liable to find copies of Northwest Brewing News lying around, what you can pick up and read if you're not willing to shell out for a subscription sight unseen. So that's the beer newspapers that are out there. If you're interested in beer, you might consider subscribing to one or the other of them just to stay up on all the latest developments. Speaking of latest developments, there's an app for that. As everybody knows these days, we're all carrying around our smartphones on our hips. So it makes sense that there's now several apps out there dealing with beer and brewing. A couple that you should probably be familiar with is Brew Guru, which is an app produced by the Brewers Association or the American Homebrewers Association that has a lot of information in it about beers and brewing. There's also an app for beer styles. The beer style guidelines produced by the Beer Judge Certification Program are available as a free app that you can download and have on at your fingertips on your smartphone. I have that on mine and find it very convenient occasionally when I'm trying to remember specifics about a particular beer or beer style to be able to call it up on my phone. Finally, the most popular app out there dealing with beer is Untappd, UNTAPPD, which is basically an app that allows you to keep track of all the beers that you have sampled. You can check in individual beers as you taste them, take pictures of them, post them. It tracks beer availability at different venues. It allows you to see what your friends are drinking, where they're drinking. It's basically a social media app dealing with beer. It's very popular. A lot of folks use it. Frankly, I'm a bit of two minds about it. I have it and I use it, but I also worry that we're going to spend so much of our time head down in our smartphones taking notes and taking pictures that we're not taking the time out to enjoy the beer and the social company aspect of having a beer. So with that caveat, I would recommend Untappd to anyone who's got a smartphone and is interested in seeing what's available and keeping track of the beers out there. So that's it for Beer Gear this month, and that's it for our show. So I hope you all had a wonderful month, and I'd like to ask you if you have any suggestions, questions, or anything else that you can give me for Drinking on the Last Frontier, please send me an email at beerontthelastfrontier@gmail.com. That's beerontthelastfrontier@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to answer your questions on or off the air. Let me give you one closing quote to keep in mind. Be wary of strong drink. It can make you shoot at tax collectors and miss. That's a quote from Robert A. Heinlein, one of the great science fiction writers of our time. Thanks, and have a great day.